Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. As we say goodbye to 2014, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite moments from this year's Louisiana Eats. Long before Michael Galata's restaurant Mofo was lauded by Bon Appetit and New Orleans Magazine, we knew he had a winner on his hands. Michael and his brother Jeff join us to talk about the concept behind one of America's best new restaurants. And our roving reporter Ryan Hughes became a culinary ambassador this year, taking Louisiana food all the way to Moscow. But sadly, the year ended with the loss of two visionary champions of Louisiana food, Michael Mizell Nelson and Rudy Lombard. We'll hear their voices one last time as we say a bittersweet auld lang syne on this week's Louisiana Eats. Brothers Michael and Jeff Galata spent more than 30 combined years working in fine dining restaurants before they decided to open up their own casual eatery in mid-city. Michael's Mofo chef, and Jeff handles front-of-the-house business. Although the atmosphere at Mofo is very laid back, there are fine dining touches the two can't seem to leave behind.
For me, it was, as long as I can remember, I loved cooking shows, and I like to cook. And my mom was actually very supportive of it, and she used to tape them for me while I was in school. And so, and actually my favorite was Yan Can Cook. And she would tape it for me, and I'd come home and watch it. And then on weekends, I was allowed to cook for everyone. And I used to do it almost every weekend. So she would buy all the food and help me do the cutting and the chopping, and I would cook.
Jeff, what about you?
I just made the accident, I think, of getting my first job in the restaurant industry. And ever since then, I had enough experience to get another job in the restaurant industry. And slowly but surely, I worked my way through college waiting tables and then on to some wine training, became an entry-level sommelier and then a maitre d', and then before I knew it, you know, looked up and the field I had chosen in college didn't exactly provide a guaranteed job, but my restaurant skills did, so here I am. Yeah, the degree in fine arts has fully qualified me to run a steakhouse for a living, a couple of other things, and now a Vietnamese restaurant.
Well, the fine dining restaurant, of course, where I first met the two of you all working together was Restaurant August. Tell me about what precipitated you leaving that top shelf establishment and breaking out on your own in this way.
Well, you know, I think what was fun about it was we wanted to do something a little more casual, and we wanted to do something in the neighborhood, and we wanted to do an industry restaurant, a restaurant for industry people, because, you know, we all kind of live in the same neighborhoods. We all travel in the same circles. We all go out together on our days off and eat. And traditionally, we eat Vietnamese food or Thai food because the flavors are really light and fresh and vibrant. And it's kind of a break for us because we're tasting heavier foods all day. And not that those foods aren't fantastic. They're fantastic. But that food, for some reason, is just what we gravitate to on our days off. And so it just worked out perfectly.
Yeah, same here. I think it was a kind of a mixture of what we enjoyed eating during our time off, in addition to the fact that I think there was kind of a need for it at the time, especially in this neighborhood. Mid-City, I think, is on the move. I think it's definitely a neighborhood that you're about to see really explode. And we just decided that, I live 3 blocks from here. I think he lives 5 blocks from here. It's nice not having to head down to the CBD every day and find a place to park and all that kind of stuff. I think it was another part of it. It was a lot easier to do it here close to home.
And I think that brings up another point, is that, you know, we wanted to be kind of away from that downtown action because we wanted to be a spot where people could sit and relax on their day off and enjoy our deck or enjoy the garage doors that open up and when the weather's nice, and a place where you don't feel rushed and you're not going to break the bank. to come here, but we're still going to source everything locally. We're still going to get all of our vegetables from Cubby Rise or Pelican Produce, and our, you know, beef from Two Run Farms, and our pigs from Chapapila, and all the great names that you know. We're still bringing it in the door here. Because we were able to come to a smaller neighborhood, we're allowed to charge more reasonable prices, which we wanted to do for families around here and the industry folks around here.
Well, I have to say, one of the things you've definitely accomplished is the dining experience is a complete 180-degree turn from Restaurant August. Tell me about, like, the choices to make some of these dramatic changes.
Yeah, I think that the setup of the tables and just the style of service and the all the way down to the cocktail and wine list and everything like that, I think it's inspired by what we've always done as fine dining restaurateurs, but not necessarily defined by it, if you will. We wanted to take kind of pick and choose, you know, pick what we wanted to bring to the table and put on the table, as the case may be, but also don't feel the need to be so... what's the word I'm looking for here? I guess
fancy.
Fancy. Yeah, I guess that's it. Yeah,
fancy.
Yeah, that's pretty much the crux of it. You don't need to be fancy. You need to. We're more worried about the ingredients and the experience and just having a good time. Sometimes I think that might get lost when you're kind of swept up in the pomp and circumstance of fine dining, all the little things at various conventions. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm a certified sommelier. I mean, this is those are the things that sort of defined my career for a really long time. And it's it was strange to swim to this other end of the pool and realize, okay, maybe we can still do this without all the steps and the sequences and the various protocols. It's been difficult not freaking out over some of these smaller things that would be anathema in fine dining. Sometimes it's almost a little refreshing to be able to look at a server and go, well, that's really not that bad. I mean, in my old job, I probably would have lost it right now had I seen that. But now it's actually a little bit fun, and the guests all laugh and smile. And as long as everybody's having a good time, I don't see any reason why we need to crack down on it the way that we once did.
What kind of mental bridges have you had to cross, Michael?
Good question. Okay, so the mental bridges we had to cross, I think we're being able to focus more on making sure what the guests got, really the flavors came through. Because, you know, we are a faster-paced restaurant as far as how many plates are sort of flying out the door. And so we can't spend as much time on the perfect plating and the things like that. So we had to make dishes that were beautiful when you got them, but more beauty out of how little you did to the food as opposed to how much you did to the food, if that makes any sense. And then also just sort of bridging that gap between growing up in New Orleans and growing up with this kind of cuisine with all the great seafood and all the long growing seasons and great produce, and sort of using that to apply to the Southeast Asian way of doing things and flavor profiles, and bringing those two together in a way that seems effortless but also makes sense. We don't want to overthink it, really. That's the one thing you can go wrong with in food, is overthinking things, and we just kind of want to do it from a point of what would we want to eat.
So what has the reaction been from your former coworkers and employers from those white tablecloth restaurants? What do they have to say?
I think in that respect, I'd like to think that we achieved our goal and that they've really enjoyed it, and to the point that they've come back again and again. You know, we roast a whole pig every Saturday on our pit out on the deck. And being out there, and it was a beautiful night, and the doors were open, and the restaurant was full, and it was like, man, I would want to sit down here.
Yeah, I think we get the same feedback from front of the house people. In fact, if anything, all the guys that I used to work next to having to wear a suit are pretty jealous that I'm wearing a mechanic shirt and a pair of jeans to work every day after spending pretty much my entire career having to pick up dry cleaning every other day. So I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of them are like, man, we need to open a casual restaurant. It looks like you're having a hell of a time. And so it is. It's a lot more fun. And some of them, I mean, they'll have brought a few things to my attention that needed to be brought to my attention, which is also a great thing. And I would do the same thing for them. We always do that kind of stuff for each other. You're always kind of looking out for each other.
So as a brother team, do you all have any differences, or have you, regarding how things go in the restaurant? And if so, how do you settle that? Is that what Jeff, your partner's for? Does he make the final decision, or how does that work?
I think we got most of our problems out of the way in our teens. Yeah, we beat those out of each other. But the good part about it is that we can sort of, when the chips are down, we can kind of lay into each other, but at the end of the day, we're just brothers, so it doesn't really matter. And now that Jeff's here, yeah, that the other Jeff, so two Jeffs and a Mike, and now that he's with us too, it's almost a newer dynamic. I think that's almost the new thing that we have to learn, because we have to pass it by all three of us, and we have to make unanimous decisions. Thankfully, we all speak the same restaurant language, all three of us, so that helps out a lot. But nowadays, there's definitely a lot more of a stop and talk things out and make sure we come to a consensus.
We still do call a lot of audibles, though. I think we definitely have a two-minute offense still. But I think that from time to time, we'll kind of lay into each other at the end of the shift a little bit. At the end of the day, I mean, it's been the easiest partnership that I've ever had as far as a chef slash general manager dynamic was working with my brother. As he was saying, we speak this, not only speak the same language, but like, you know, Jeff Bybee and I have the common background of both coming up through the ranks at the Emeralds Group, so we speak that language together. Mike worked there briefly, but then he spent a lot of his time coming through the ranks at the Besh Group, so all three of us, you know, speak the Besh language. And we have these points of reference that we can kind of bounce off of each other. Again, it's calling an audible, but it's a play we all already know from one of the places where we worked. We're tweaking it a little bit, making it our own, you know, just having fun with it. And that's, I think that's another thing that we've been able to do here, is have a lot more fun with it and keep it a lot more engaging from our standpoint as owners and operators.
There's a lot of fusion food around. There's a lot of people claiming to fuse one country to another country. And Michael, I feel like you took some traditional things and tweaked them. Did you think that traditional New Orleans food was becoming stale and needed to evolve?
I don't think that. I think there's always a place for those altars of great New Orleans cuisine. But I also think that a lot of the great restaurants were born out of that. You know, all the great New Orleans Italian restaurants, they're not Italian. They're New Orleans Italian. Even, you know, the Brennan's family, you know, even though they tried to make a great French restaurant, they're Irish. And it's just the way it is. And it's the way that New Orleans assimilates its cultures. And the most recent influxes have been, you know, the Vietnamese and the Hondurans, and they haven't yet assimilated. And in a lot of respects, they're not. They're sort of moving out and forming their own communities. And maybe it'll only take a few more generations for them to do that. But I also think that we can take that cuisine and make it more New Orleans, or find a New Orleans approach to it. The one example I like to use is whenever I go eat fermented white bean braised seafood at any of the Vietnamese restaurants, it always reminds me of gumbo. And so when we brought the dish here, I said, well, let's roast those crabs in the pan, and let's make a really dark roux, and then let's start it like we would start a great seafood gumbo, but then let's add in that fermented black bean paste, and let's add in those fresh fermented black beans, and then we can make this really complex sauce that is both a New Orleans dish for any New Orleans who eats it, but also Vietnamese for any Vietnamese person who eats it, and sort of bridge that gap. And so it's finding those similarities between the two cultures and the two cuisines, thinking how, in a few decades, how would that culture assimilate, as opposed to just sort of fusing and ramming things together? You know, how would New Orleans assimilate it like it has done to so many other great cultures that have immigrated here?
I think if there's been any sort of kind of backlash that we have had in the beginning, it was people assuming that we were going to be traditional. And they come in here and they kind of would freak out a little bit that, like, this isn't like I get it on the West Bank. This isn't like I get it in New Orleans East. And it's like, no, it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't even remotely meant to be.
We want you to know that you're in New Orleans when you're eating in this dining room. We don't want it to be that you could be in any Vietnamese restaurant anywhere in the country. We want you to know that you're in a New Orleans restaurant first, and then a Vietnamese-inspired restaurant second.
Well,
definitely.
It's working. And so I have to ask, what's next for the amazing Galata brothers?
Oh.
A day off?
Yeah.
That would be great. A day off would be wonderful. One of the dreams I think we always had was making the style of cooking and the style of service and everything like that that we had worked in more approachable and affordable to, I mean, I remember back when I was a waiter, I couldn't afford to eat. I still can't afford to eat at half the restaurants that I worked at. For all the time I worked in fine dining, most of the restaurants that I've worked at, I probably went and sat down once, maybe twice. Did I eat a lot of food at Restaurant August? Absolutely. But it was standing in the back in the kitchen next to him, tasting stuff, or, you know, what do you think of this dish? You know, that sort of thing. I very rarely had the opportunity to come in and sit down and do the sort of, you know, grand tasting and wine pairings and things like that, that I was part of designing and a part of helping with. But I think what we want to do here is maybe give those, again, those waiters and waitresses and cooks and stuff like that a chance to come in here and afford to eat a tasting menu, to taste some wine, and to maybe get a little bit of the craft that we're trying to perfect.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come out the kitchen and off the floor and sit down in the dining room here at MoFo with us.
Pleasure was all ours. Thank you.
It was a great experience. Thank you.
MoFo's Michael and Jeff Galata.
Oh, a little dab of duty.
This past February, Whole Foods Market launched its third location in the New Orleans area with a festive return to the Mid-City neighborhood. As part of a new food hub, dubbed the Refresh Project, the grocery has helped stimulate economic growth and provided access to high-quality food throughout the community. On an overcast winter morning, hundreds of residents gathered in the parking lot for free coffee, pastries, and live music. Ernest Roy, the store's new team leader, took the stage among city leaders and introduced his crew.
Good morning, New Orleans. Who are we?
Broad Street.
Who are we?
Broad Street.
Who are we?
Broad Street.
That's your store, New Orleans. I guess they're ready to open the doors, right?
Shopping. Good morning.
We're here. We made it. We're celebrating the new Whole Foods store in Mid-City. First things first, I would like a cup of coffee. It's a little early. So we might grab some breakfast here today.
Hey, are you looking for something?
Yeah, flaxseed.
Like, do you
know flaxseed? My name is Suyeni. I'm from Brazil, but I live here for 15 years. I'm having my coffee and my croissant. Looks great, everybody's happy. Good for our neighborhood, right? We're just buying a new house around here, so I'm very happy to have Whole Foods around. I think it's going to be a big thing for the whole neighborhood.
Here's this, I'm going to grab your shrimp for you.
Two jalapeno salmon patties.
Thank you so much. Two jalapeno salmon patties and a pound of brown shrimp.
I came to look for some juice and bacon.
The juice bar.
But I don't know if they have one.
They might not have a juice bar. But they definitely have bacon. And we wanted to see what all the fuss was about, because they said there was a line on Facebook. And I think people are really excited for this place to be here, to be open.
Super exciting.
Yeah. She can get six different kinds of quinoa. Where can you get six kinds of quinoa?
It's chaotic in here and very, you know, bumper to bumper, everybody has a basket, everybody's getting everything. You can feel the excitement, you can feel the joy and the happiness of the people who are excited to have something like this in our neighborhood. My passion has always been nutrition, so I'm all about fresh food and vegetables and, you know, trying to incorporate New Orleans style traditional food healthy, you know, a healthier version.
My name's Rudy, and I'm pretty far into the building, and there's quite a substantial line. There's many people way behind me going back, wrapping around the building. I think it's comparable to when Trader Joe's opened in Baton Rouge, actually. I was there, too. Lots of people standing around. Probably wish they had baskets, but we're all having a good time, so. The Whole Foods brand products are on sale, so I stocked up on a bunch. Planning on making some hummus, so I bought a lot of chickpeas, and they're giving away some meat, so I picked up some free meat. Going to make some kale chips, and stocked up on some spices, some turmeric and some mustard seed. So they have a wide selection. I was surprised. We do some shopping at Rouse's. We also shop at the farmer's market, but now that it's just a small bike ride away, we're really excited to have one right in our backyard.
All right. Nice. You
So you got the different labels and the different brands. Each little region across the land. Different colors in the different states. Different labels. And let's tell about Bates are all the different states for all their different traits. And as of this date, I hate no state. Let's rock. Let's go.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. This past summer, Chef Ryan Hughes was selected as a culinary ambassador to the Usadba Jazz Festival in Russia. He was expected to cook for thousands of people, and although he was given plenty support from his Russian hosts, Ryan learned the hard way that certain things will always get lost in translation.
Poppy, I sent a list of about 15 different dishes that were good representations of New Orleans or Louisiana or Southern food, let's say that, you know. And I was like, all right, guys, you pick your top two, and then we'll start breaking down recipes, and I'll start teaching you how to do it via Skype and via email. So what do these guys do is instead of picking two recipes, they email me back immediately, and they're like, okay, we'll take all 12 recipes.
Oh, goodness.
So I was like, hold on a second. No, we're not doing 12 recipes. They were like, well, we can do it all. And I'm like, no, you can't. And I thought the only really way to teach these guys that it's not as easy as just giving somebody a recipe or a dish and following through with it, I was like, okay, guys, I was like, I'll make you a deal. I'm going to give you one recipe at a time. I want you to replicate the recipe, take pictures as you go, and then send it back to me, and I'll okay it before we move on to the next recipe.
So you've been teaching via Skype already?
Via Skype and through email. Yeah. So the first recipe I gave him was seafood gumbo. So how do you teach somebody who's never even tasted a seafood gumbo before in their life, not only taste like, but replicate it for 20, 30,000 people at the same time? So I was like, look, I was like, these are the steps. I even went to my old Paul Prudhomme cookbooks. You know how great those are.
Can
look at the pictures
so
he did of the different stages of roux. And where to take certain roux and how to cut the vegetables and this is the right size of shrimp and whatnot. So I showed him via pictures, and sure enough, it took him almost a week and a half just to get down the gumbo recipe. This is without me obviously even tasting it, where I felt that I was even able to get him to a point where we can step in a couple days earlier and then me adjust certain
and tweak
things.
It.
And then just tweak it. Exactly.
So what else have you taught them now?
So I taught them the seafood gumbo. And then, okay, so think about, you know, your typical Louisiana or fair or festival food that represents our culture. So I did some studying, and sure enough, all over Russia are crayfish.
Crawfish.
Exactly. Crawfish. So I started looking up recipes, and back in the day when there were all these czars, you know, before communist Russia, they had all the best top French classical chefs working for these gazillionaires, whatnot, you know, these people. And the classical French way to do a crawfish dish was, if you look up, it's called nantua, which is basically a creamed crawfish. And they put it sometimes over rice or with crepes or a vol-au-vent or whatnot. So I was like, can you get crawfish? And of course, they corrected me, crayfish. Yes, we can get crayfish. And I'm like, okay, here's a recipe for a crawfish boil. They've got the corn, they got potatoes, and we figured out that they have a similar type of sausage as andouille. It's a smoked large sausage. So I sent them the recipe with all the pictures, and I gave them the great pictures. We all see this of picnic tables with the crawfish all sprawled out on newspaper. And this also works really well because they actually weigh the product, and that's how they charge for it. A couple days later, I get a email response. He's got 20 different pictures of the stages of a crawfish boil. They showed me this picture, and it's on this fancy porcelain plate that's got like the scalloped edges and rims. And there are, I'm not kidding, Poppy, it's three crawfish the size of small lobsters perched on top of each other with like a little fennel frond garnish on top. And that was the crawfish boil. They thought that the corn, the meat, you know, the andouille and the potatoes were, and the whole garlic, you got to have that, of course, in the crawfish bowl, was just a flavoring component in there. And the end result was just a couple crawfish that were perched on a plate to do that.
Perhaps he should have considered that a warning. Ever the optimist, Ryan moved forward and stayed in touch with his team of Russian chefs via Skype. When he landed in Moscow after a 14-hour flight, he took some time to soak in the city, then headed out to the festival grounds for two cooking demonstrations in a single weekend.
When us as chefs do these cooking demonstrations, we know, you know, it's more for show. We obviously want it to taste great, but there's so many different variables that are there, you know, cooking on stage in front of people. So I was pretty explicit with the guys. You'll have everything else prepared to sell because we're serving for thousands of people, right? So I get there and just kind of walking around, you know, kind of meandering through the crowd, just talking to people. And a lot of people were expecting us and they were really excited. So it was fascinating. And then I get up there an hour before I'm supposed to cook on stage my demo. And here's the chef. He pulls out 50 pounds of chicken.
Oh, dear.
You know exactly where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Huh? What they wanted me to do was to do the cooking demonstration, but also to have the same dish, the jambalaya, to feed 2,000 or 3,000 people all
no.
at once.
No.
I'm not kidding. No, I was like, holy, are you kidding me? So I got a little, I didn't get angry. You don't want to get angry at anything, especially right before you're going to do a cooking demonstration like that. And everybody there was so gracious and great. But I really didn't have a choice. So here they brought out this big cast iron pot, this huge cast iron cauldron, this other kind of lackey. You know, he was like low man on the totem pole at the in the kitchen. He was up there building this huge fire underneath it. So the top Russian news crews were there filming. Russian won.
No pressure.
No. Well, that was cool. It was fine. But of course, I had to make it not only look good and entertaining within, I had just 45 minutes to do this, but to also make it taste decent for 3,000 people because this was their first introduction to Louisiana food at the same time.
I don't know how you did that. How did you
I
do
didn't.
That?
Well, I did it, but
I mean, I can fake the gumbo in 45 and have it taste good.
Exactly.
But it requires a lot of prep.
It's a lot of prep. Well, they had everything cut for me, but they didn't have the stock hot. They were making like this amazing mulled wine, you know, so they had a burner like in this little tent. So I ripped off the mulled wine, the big pot, and then this Russian guy was looking at me like, what are you doing? I was like, no, we got to get the stock on here right now. And I'm trying to explain to him in English, you know, and my little cute little translator, she was following me around trying to keep up. She's like, oh, my God, this guy's crazy. What is he doing? I was like, no, this is what I've got to do, you know, get the stock hot. You had to make light of it. So I made a big joke of it, you know, just kind of carrying on with people. But what was funny, though, was the musicians on the main stage, we were set up kind of adjacent to it. They kind of caught wind what was going on. And so they just started laughing. They're like, hey, Chef Ryan, when's that going to be ready? Blah, blah, blah. You know, they're kind of making like – they were from New Orleans too.
Oh.
There was a Hot 8 brass band was there and all these other musicians. So it was pretty cool.
So you were under this incredible pressure to cook this jambalaya suddenly in 45 minutes for 3,000 people. And the New Orleans band is catcalling you from the stage.
Catcalling me, yes.
How did it all turn out?
I wanted to do the whole Martha Stewart, Julia Child thing where you turn around and then pop it out of the oven and then boom, you're ready. Because guess what? I didn't have any to do that. So there were people literally, Poppy, waiting in line, 30, 40 people deep, ready to buy this jambalaya off of them. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? What do I do? So I sped up the process, added a little bit less stock, and added it as I went to the end just to try to speed it up. Because we all know, you know, to do it, to do a proper Cajun jambalaya, you need a really good hard cook or sear on the chicken and the vegetables. You want that Mylar reaction to happen where you've got some brown bits at the bottom of the pot and you're scraping it. But when you're putting 40 pounds of chicken in there, it's not really browning the way that you want it to brown. Or it's not browning at all. It's basically steaming. And once you got it in there, there's nothing to do. So I put the lid back on it. I grabbed one of the lackeys, the Russian guys, and I'm like, okay, you stand here and you wait till it's done. I got down off the stage and went up to the different media outlets from Russia One, and I did interviews, and I walked up and down to the crowd who were waiting, and there were other foods to serve them.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't the jambalaya. Thank God. Can you imagine? So I kind of bided our time for a while. I bided an extra half hour, 45 minutes. Actually, what happened, though, was just in the long cooking process of it, the rice actually overcooked a little bit on there. So that even bugged me even more. I'm like, are you kidding me? I went through all this and here's the rice being overcooked a little bit. You can't do it like that, you know, not jambalaya that big.
I'd like to tell you that this story has a happy ending, but when Ryan showed up to cook gumbo on stage, it was deja vu all over again. There's always going to be some miscommunication when crossing cultures, but once the stress of the festival was over, Ryan went on to cook Louisiana style for 16 days all across Russia.
So the second week I was going around, I would go meet people and I would have to actually ask for directions, and I'd point to my phone like a picture, every single person. They would actually get off the subway stop a stop or two early just to show me off of where I should go. Complete strangers.
Oh.
And they knew I was American. They said, you know, the people that I was with, they said they could spot me a mile away just from being American, how I looked and whatnot. But they were just more than gracious.
That's Ryan Hughes, chef owner at Purlieu at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. In the last month of this year, Louisiana lost two of our greatests, professor and culinary historian Michael Mizell Nelson and civil rights activist Dr. Rudy Lombard, who also authored Creole Feast. When we come back from a short break, we'll have one last visit with these two great men. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. In our first year of production, the crew of Louisiana Eats took a streetcar ride with historian Michael Mizell Nelson. During our ride, Michael told us incredible stories about New Orleans streetcars and food. In his research, he had definitively proved that it was during the streetcar strikes of 1929, what was once known as a loaf became our iconic poor boy sandwich. He championed the poor boy loaf with such passion that in 2004, he helped form the Poor Boy Preservation Society, a group that later began the annual Oak Street Poor Boy Festival. On Monday, December 1st, at the age of 49, Michael Mizell Nelson lost his battle with cancer. We wanted to honor and remember our friend Michael with one last streetcar ride.
Well, there were a lot of stories about the streetcar strike, and I heard those. But there are other stories, too, about how the Po' Boy sandwich got its name. But I started to look into it just to try and see if I might find some evidence, and I stumbled across a letter from the Martin brothers, who had a coffee stand and restaurant in the French Market. And it was among many letters from businesses, coffee companies, furniture stores, people who are donating goods and services on behalf of the strikers in 1929. But then I started to look at some of the menus, and I wanted to see when did the term po' boy or poor boy start to appear on the menus. And of course, old-time New Orleanians remember loaves. Sometimes you'll still see that on menus. Loaves for the French bread sandwiches. So you don't see that occurring until the early 1930s. So it is something that develops out of there. Now, it's the term poor boy and sandwich together. That's what happens after the strike.
Streetcars were commonly used for food delivery. So how did that work?
Well, it worked in a couple of ways. One, if somebody placed an order for groceries down the line, the grocer might come out, put a small box or bag of groceries, and offer a small tip, a cup of coffee or gum or cigarettes, for the motorman and the conductor to to stop at a certain point. There'd be someone waiting down the line. Pharmacists did the same thing if there was a special order and somebody needed some medicine right away. So it was sort of a delivery service that everyone might be able to use, and it was, you know, just part of the charm of the streetcar.
Was food ever sold on the streetcars?
It was in sort of strange circumstances. At the end of the magazine line, I have a wonderful story collected from a conductorette who spoke of people coming over from the Batchers, some of the squatters who lived close to Auburn Park, and they might carry catfish through the gills and board the streetcar briefly and try and make a sale. And in a sense, it's kind of like a mini or a micro market. At the end of the line, people coming home from work, you might have people who are trying to sell produce from their garden, catfish that have been caught in the river. So the most likely thing you'd see on the streetcar would be the newspaper boys who are allowed to board, ride for two blocks, get off, and then board again, the car going in the opposite direction. So you would see food that would be sold nearby, but you weren't supposed to eat on the streetcar.
Okay, no eating on the streetcar, but just caught almost wiggling catfish, okay. Was there any food that was banned on the streetcar?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories. I was interviewing a superintendent, Janson, and Mr. Janson remembers that there was a regulation banning any sort of crawfish being brought onto the streetcar. You could bring crabs, you could bring, and then again, these could be live crabs caught out at West End if you're catching the West End car to go back to town. You could bring shrimp, but you are not allowed to bring crawfish. And I asked him about that, and his memory is that there was fear of some virus that caused the health department to say, no crawfish. And yet he remembers that you'd have all kinds of, you know, odors and water dripping from the baskets of crabs that were allowed on the car, but never any crawfish.
Now, the motorman had some special privileges when it came to transporting food, I think.
Yes, actually, one thing would happen, and this, again, is an example of how most of the streetcar barns, and there were, you know, five of them at one point during the height of street railways, you would live in the neighborhood, and if someone was working an evening shift, either his wife or sometimes his entire family or one of his children would bring some sort of hot meal and perhaps ride with their father going around the belt and get a chance to spend some time even while he was at work.
Well, that brings a whole new reality to the family dinner table. That is a charming thing. Any other animals?
Well, one of my favorite stories, too, is connected to the St. Claude line. And so, again, this would take people into St. Bernard Parish. And at times, some of the men would make deals with people who are raising cows and cattle. And in certain cases, if they had a big party, they might purchase a veal calf. And it would be living. They'd tie it up and they'd stick it under the longitudinal or beauty seats that people see at the very front, those long benches.
Oh, that's what the beauty seat is. It's the long bench. Okay.
Right. The long bench up at the front. And so they would actually take the calf back into the city, and they might take it to one of the neighborhood butchers and then, you know, essentially split the calf up. And so that's one of the more bizarre examples of food on the streetcar. Still a living, breathing calf, you know, sometimes making sounds under the beauty seat.
That's a wonderful story. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your streetcar food stories with us on Louisiana Eats.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Streetcar historian and poor boy champion, Michael Mizell Nelson. Aside from streetcars and poor boys, Michael Mizell Nelson had a passion for New Orleans Russian cake. Although several area bakeries still make the cake, which is mostly made from cake scraps, Michael was always worried that his favorite childhood cake might disappear. Times-Picayune food writer Miriam Giedros was also a Russian cake lover. She published a recipe for it back in the 70s that not only called for 15 pounds of day-old cake, but also required cooks to build a large wooden frame to press and mold the cake. But don't let that deter you. Think about it this way. If you quarter the recipe, you can still make it in a large springform pan. To make the Russian cake, you start with a white cake split in half. Fit the first half into the springform pan and then mix together any assortment of cake scraps that might be available. Almond cake, yellow cake, devil's food cake, anything. Even things like jelly donuts or coffee cake are acceptable. Break the cake scraps into chunks, then moisten them with a rum and sugar syrup. Add enough syrup so the chunks stick together, and then place them on top of the first white cake layer. Dab jelly all over that, and then put the second layer of white cake on top. Place the removable bottom of the springform pan on top of the whole thing, and here comes the strange part. Put a couple of bricks on top and let it compress for 4 days. To finish the Russian cake, frost the top with any kind of white icing, then decorate it with brightly colored sprinkles, a crucial step in the process. Voila! Russian cake. Whether you make your own or buy one from your favorite local bakery, when you dive into that boozy, crazy cake, you can be sure that Michael Mizell Nelson is smiling. You can find a copy of this recipe at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Russian cake is real Louisiana eats. Dr. Rudy Lombard was a man of principle who believed in equality. As a civil rights activist in New Orleans, Rudy staged a sit-in at McCrory's lunch counter, an act of civil disobedience that led to the landmark Supreme Court case, which ended segregation in restaurants. Lombard versus Louisiana. Now, take us back to those days of the lunch counter sit-ins. What propelled you into action?
I think for me, my mother cooked for one of the wealthy families in New Orleans. It was the Stewart, John Stewart family. They lived on the corner of Dryads and Napoleon, across the street from one of the better-known restaurants, Manali's. And when I was a kid, I used to accompany my mother to work. But I was curious as hell about what went on at Manali's. And sort of resolved that one of these days I was going to go in that restaurant. And I knew then, as a kid, that blacks were not allowed to go.
What was Lombard versus Louisiana, and how did that turn out?
Well, the Lombard case came out of a sit-in we did at McCrory's. Myself, Oretha Haley, Lanny Goldfinch, and Cecil Carter. That was the second week of some sit-ins we were doing on Canal Street. They accused us of criminal trespassing and so forth and so on. And the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And my name got attached to the case that involved the other students and myself. There were five cases that were heard at the same time. And the ruling was that it was unconstitutional to discriminate against people on the basis of race in a place of public accommodation. So it made it possible for blacks and whites to go to the same places, restaurant, hotels, whatever, whatever.
So what happened? What happened when you all went in and took
Well, they asked us to leave, and when we refused, they arrested us. What the difference in the situation that we participated in was that the mayor insisted that blacks not be served in those places of public. And as a result, ultimately, the United States Supreme Court said, well, this wasn't an issue of private property, because if the mayor insisted that the local codes be enforced, which were not on the books so much, but it was the tradition of not serving blacks and whites in places of public accommodation, the fact that he insisted on us being arrested and being denied service made it a case that took it out of the realm of, say, private property and made it a public action. And so his involvement made it such that the court ruled this was not an issue of public accommodation, but state action in effect.
Well, one place where I know that you were always welcome was at Dookie Chase Restaurant.
Absolutely.
And I have heard tell of many tales of the infamous upstairs room at Dookie Chase Restaurant. And could you tell me what was going on up there?
Well, when the Civil Rights Movement came along, the whites who participated in the Civil Rights Movement would go to Dookie Chase and enjoy a meal along with the blacks. And the police never bothered us at Dookie's. So we always knew that Dookie would be a refuge for whatever it is we were involved in. And we got the support of the Chase family to do that.
Now, Leah tells me, you know, a lot of people don't seem to remember that it was just as illegal for white people to eat in black restaurants as it was for black people to eat in white restaurants. And
absolutely.
And yet somehow Dookie Chase was the place where everybody came together to find that common working ground that we moved forward on. Yeah. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I can tell you it was true, and I can tell you it was illegal. But I think a lot of white politicians ate in private parties at Dookie Chase. So she knew a lot of them. And they could never do it in public with a group of black men and women. Blacks and whites were always welcome at Dookie Chase, no matter how radical it was perceived by the general public and the politicians and the civil authority of the city and the state and so forth. It didn't matter to them. They were stand-up kind of people. Now, there also was a woman working at Dookie's by the name of Virgie Castle, and she did the same thing. She had blacks and whites who came to her house to eat, and in many cases to stay there if we couldn't find a place for them to live while they were involved with the Freedom Rides or anything else we did. So between, you know, the Castles, Leah and her family, that was our sanctuary. For me, long before the 60s, but from the 60s onward.
Rudy, how were you involved with the Freedom Riders?
Well, I was a national officer of the Congress of Racial Equality, national vice president. So I was involved in the planning of the Freedom Rides. And that was really the second Freedom Rides. In 1947, there was a ride sponsored by CORE called the Journey of Reconciliation. And that was an attempt to test whether or not the United States government and the United States Supreme Court had implemented a decision in a case called the Irene Morgan case. Irene Morgan case in the early 40s was about a black woman who refused to give up her seat in interstate travel. They arrested Irene Morgan. Her case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And the court ruled that discrimination, racial discrimination in interstate travel was unconstitutional. So in 61, the Congress of Racial Equality decided to plan a second Freedom Ride. So I was involved in the planning at the national level. And, you know, I think at least 40% of the Freedom Riders in the second wave came through New Orleans, which is an untold story. When the bus was bombed in Anniston, Alabama, and the mob attacked the initial Freedom Riders in Montgomery, those rides were aborted, and they flew all those people here. And we didn't have enough houses for them to stay in. So we put a lot of them up at St. Michael's Dormitory on the campus of Xavier University. And that's a story that most people don't know about.
Civil rights activist Rudy Lombard. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to managing producer Thomas Walsh and associate producer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. Happy New Year! Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.